I think the thing for me was I didn't want to be 40 and hate my job. And at that moment, I was hating my job.
Welcome to No Limits. I'm Rebecca Jarvis. Each week, we're talking to women playing at the top of their game. Founders, actors, athletes, chefs, comedians, musicians. Bottom line, these are women who win. So how are they doing it? We're taking you way beyond the bios, looking at their struggles, triumphs, risks, biggest mistakes, and some of the worst advice they've heard along the way. Whether you're looking for answers or you just want to hear a good story, you're in the right place. You might recognize today's guest by her favorite line, Hootie Who. It was her signature line that we all came to know and love while she competed on Bravo's Top Chef. She is an entrepreneur of the food world who wasn't originally on that path, or at least it didn't look like it. She started out in Nashville, Tennessee, studied business at Howard University, did a brief stint in accounting for PricewaterhouseCoopers, but before leaving all of it behind to travel Europe, where she discovered a passion for all things culinary. Cooking with love is the central ingredient in all her cookbooks, and most recently, her very first restaurant opened this past June, Carla Hall's Southern Kitchen, described as a love letter to Nashville, which is now in Brooklyn, New York. Oh, and she's also a co-host on the Emmy Award-winning series, The Chew. No big deal there. Carla Hall, welcome.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you. And I was when I was looking over your resume and your bio, I wanted to know what was going through your mind at that point that you said, you know what, no more PricewaterhouseCoopers, no more business, I'm off to Europe.
I think the thing for me was I didn't want to be 40 and hate my job. And at that moment, I was hating my job. And
what did you hate about it?
I loved studying accounting. I felt like I was boxed in. And I was in public accounting, so you're not really in the same office. You're going to your clients' offices. And there was an accountant who, I was doing an audit in Ocala, Florida, and I swear it was like 106 degrees, all 100% humidity, and I was dying. And I felt nauseous. And I looked over and I saw this accountant taking this piece of paper and lining up the edges, and he was folding it, and I was looking at him with horror, and I'm like, oh my goodness, that can't be me in, you know, 25 years. And so I said, I'm quitting.
You just did it right then and there.
I tendered my resignation that next Monday, and I was gone in 2 weeks.
And how did you decide on Europe?
Well, I had been modeling at Howard University, and then I met some girls when I was living in Tampa, Florida, when I was working at PricewaterhouseCoopers. At the time, it was just PricewaterhouseCoopers before they became PricewaterhouseCoopers. And so it was a way for me to meet people, and I met these girls who were moving to France, and I said, you know what? I think I'll do that too.
It was just
like that. And I think I was the biggest fear for me was hating my job at 40. And when I look back, people are like, weren't you scared to go to a foreign country and you didn't know the language and you didn't know anyone? I mean, I had one telephone number when I went. All I knew was I was afraid of failure and I didn't want that job. That's all I knew.
And then what did you do?
So then I was living in a pensione in the 14th arrondissement.
I lived in the 14th arrondissement.
Really?
Yes.
No!
At Cité Université.
Oh, listen,
anyway, we'll talk about that later, another day.
So wait, you can appreciate this. I didn't know that much French. I learned a little bit of French when I was in Tampa by somebody who was there on a tour of duty. And... And so I learned a little bit of French and I went down to order. It was like the first day I was there and I go to this patisserie and I said, "En croissant du beurre, s'il vous plaît." I said, "En croissant du beurre." And she would not give it to me until I pronounced it correctly. Now, this was back in the late 80s. So
wow.
I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to starve here. Good for modeling, bad for personal reasons. And
of all places to starve, Paris is not one that you want to not be eating in.
I know, right? Right. So, and that's where I learned, that's where I fell in love with food, you know?
So you're there. What were you taking with you from your life that you were applying at this point?
I think it was honestly my discipline for, and I have these same little books that I kept. Everything that I spent, I knew how much money I had. So everything that I spent, I don't care if it was like, you know, five cents or whatever, I wrote it down, and I had a list of daily. I knew how much money I could spend. So at this point, I'm literally been an accountant for my own life. And I also used my skills of like going into an office and meeting people and being able to talk to strangers. That's what I did, because I had to go to a lot of go-sees, being a model, and how I had to handle myself and what I had to wear and how I had to present, and just being professional. Because at this point, I was, 24, 25? Yeah.
You were young.
I was young.
Were you always as outgoing as we all know you to be?
The funny thing is, a lot of people think that I'm outgoing, but I'm actually borderline introvert, extrovert, which no one knows. And Michael Simon mentions it occasionally on the show, because when I'm at somebody's house, I'm so chilled. And I've even had people come up to me on the street and say, "Are you okay? You don't seem as fun as you are on television."
No.
And I'm like, "No, I'm just chilling. I'm good."
You don't want to have to always be performing.
No,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
So you grew up kind of on between. Sometimes you're introverted, sometimes you're extroverted.
Right.
When you ended up going and doing Bravo.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. What was that like for you?
That was it was an adventure. My six-word advice to anybody is, say yes, adventure follows, then growth. So that's those my advice in six words.
And keep track of your money.
And
accounting
keep track,
style.
Right, and keep track of your money, because there will be no growth. So my whole thing there, it was a personal challenge. And I didn't realize how popular the show was. I just went on as a personal challenge. And then I just kept going. And I was 42 years old at the time. I don't think they expected me to really go through the whole thing. You know, it's probably one of those throwaway contestants, because they have like a whole formula that they do. And I was a caterer too. So I wasn't from one of these big restaurants and, you know, that everyone knows. I was this little caterer from Washington, D.C., and I was 42 years old. But the thing is, I was this person who had been, you know, in London and Paris, and I made things happen. And then as a caterer and being my own boss, you have to make it work. It's like, make it work. You know, whatever you have to be flexible, and you have to think on your feet, and you have to just get her done. And all of that changing in different kitchens and different ingredients. I'm like, okay, this is what we have. This is what we have, you know, and you work with it.
That it's a really good point, because I think anybody who sees it all from the outside, you assume that it's just kind of perfect, that everything is just made to order and all. But no, that's not how any of this stuff goes.
Oh, absolutely not. No, it's real. The challenges are real. Whenever you see on television, and even if it's on the Chew and we're giving away $5, you know, you have to have the attorney sign off on it. It has to be a fair contest. So, you know, the timing was real. The challenges were real. Nothing, you know, nothing given to us in advance. And, you know, and it was really stressful. I must admit, it was really stressful. But then at some point when I was at the judges table and I was on the bottom, I said, wait a minute, no one has ever died here. Has anybody seen anybody die? No, nobody died. Okay, I'm good.
The
I'm
stakes
good.
Are not so crazy.
Exactly. They're not. It's not life or death. It's, you know, are you going to move on or aren't you? And what I also realized, and this was a life lesson there, when you were on the top, you got feedback from all these amazing chefs whom you would have never met. And when you're on the bottom, you got feedback. When you're in the middle, you get nothing. And so in my head, I said, okay, so for me, I either want to be on the top or the bottom, because these are people that I may never speak to. I may never get, you know, this nugget of knowledge from. So I'm open wherever I'm going to get it. And you know, and where if I'm on the bottom, I'm going to take this information. I'm going to use it the next time. And that's how I sort of matriculate it through.
And so that almost says to me that you're somebody who believes in taking big swings. You're not trying to play it safe ever.
Right. I do. I take big swings. But, you know, it's calculated risks. You know, I learn from my mistakes. I learned not to be afraid of failing. You know, I learned to just say, okay, you know, this didn't work out. I'm okay. And the only thing that's hurt is my ego.
How did you learn that in the beginning?
I think I learned it on Top Chef. And, you know, and at the time, again, I was 42. And I look back, when you're in your 30s, you're like, oh my God, everything matters. Everything matters. And honestly, when you get to be older, you're like, okay, it's time to really start learning from your mistakes. And I think okay, I've been here before. What did I learn? It's the what makes it hard is when people don't learn, when they don't learn from their mistakes and they feel like they have to be so perfect. But the thing is, life isn't perfect. And those mistakes help other people as they're watching you, and they also help yourself.
I would imagine along the way you've also received a lot of advice.
Yes.
Some of it good, some of it awful.
I think my grandmother always said, it's your job to be happy, not rich. You know, I think that was...
That it's a choice. Is that what she was saying?
Well, it's a choice, but yes, your job, it's being happy is your choice. And focus on your happiness and don't focus on your pocketbook. Because if you focus on your happiness, the pocketbook will come. I mean, and whether it comes at 40 or whether it comes at 60, it will come. But the journey is the joyful part. And even when you're down on your knees and you're crying in the shower, and I've been there... You know, I've gotten up and I was like, okay, I can go to the next thing, and even that's hard. But I'm like, okay, this is not going to last forever. So,
people see you on the Chew all the time. Big fan myself.
Thank you.
And you have such a you exude that happiness all of the time. And I do wonder when I see someone like yourself so happy, when the down moments were and how you rose up from them.
I can even talk about the Chew. I must tell you, the first season of The Chew, I thought I was going to get fired. I mean,
why?
Every day, because it was so hard. It was so different and such a departure from what I had done. So people are like, well, you were on television. Yes, but I wasn't a host. I wasn't interviewing. I wasn't cooking, interviewing, and hosting at the same time, which is a three-ring circus. And when somebody makes it easy, when you're looking at somebody who's done it, like Michael Simon and Mario, because they've done it, they did it on the Food Network, when they make it look easy, they're really good.
Right, because it's not easy. That's the key. You make it look easy because it's actually not. There are a million things going on behind the scenes
Yes.
that no one has any clue about.
And then, you know, so you'll have an executive producer talking in your ear with that IFB. And I remember it was the first season, probably in the first couple of weeks, and I'm doing this dish, and the executive producer, Gordon Elliott, is saying, egg. And I'm looking around, and then he keeps saying, egg, egg. And so finally, I respond back out loud. No one can hear him, but you can hear me. And I'm like, egg.
Having a conversation with the voices in my head.
Exactly. I just keep saying, egg. And Michael Simon walks over laughing, that wonderful, infectious laugh. And he's like, Carla, put the egg in the pan. I'm like, oh, put the egg in the pan.
But that's the beauty of having a team that supports you in these kinds of things.
So
in your head, you were doubting yourself. How did you manage to get through that? Because not only are you thinking that, but there's the whole world. Everyone's commenting. You know, you have social media. You have your executive producer. Who knows what else you were paying attention to at the time?
No, and I for two seasons, it was really hard. I would go home and I would cry because it was so hard. And I'm like, I can't do this. And I remember a friend telling me, this is just a lesson. Your prayer every day should be authenticity. And I got it. I'm like, okay. And then I hit this wall where I was so frustrated. And I went to the producers and this is not working for me. And I went on and on and on. And basically I said to them everything that was in my head. I cried, I screamed, I yelled. And I said everything that was in my head, because I said, if I get fired, I don't want to sit at home and say, I wish I had said blah, blah, blah. So after that whole thing, and I'm looking at them, and I'm like, I'm not turning away. And in my head, I remember looking at them like I was looking at the judges at Top Chef. Nobody ever died there, and nobody's ever going to die here. And they got up, and they were like,
wow.
Thank you. Now you have arrived. Now you can get to work. And it really was just showing up as myself. And a lot of times, I think, especially in television and radio, and when you are in the public eye, people think you're supposed to be this model of something that, and it's not yourself. The thing is, the viewers can see that you have to show up as yourself. So every day my prayer is authenticity. And when I choose to work with different people, when I choose to do endorsements, I make sure that I like the product. So I don't have to just tell you whatever is in a script. I'm telling you what my feelings are about it, because that's really important to me.
That authenticity is, there's a drought of authenticity, I would say, nowadays. As much as we're told constantly that we're surrounded by it, mm-hmm. it is hard to come by. And I think part of it is that vulnerability that you're talking about. I mean, the person that you put forward
right.
might not appeal
That's
might
it.
Not work. That's but you it. Know what? If you're not doing that, if you're not really being true to yourself, yeah. then there's always going to be that inside thing that's broken somehow, in my opinion.
No, that's absolutely true. And in this meeting, basically, I said I'd rather be fired for the person I am than the person that than to
being
be fired.
Bad at doing
oh
the person that they want me to be or whatever.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you mean because I'm not in the exact same industry, but we're kind of in the same yeah. world. And yeah, it's. There's plenty of pressure out there to completely conform to something else. Mm-hmm. And it's if it doesn't feel natural to you and you're doing it only so-so, there's nothing yes. worse than that feeling of I didn't do myself.
Yes.
I didn't put myself out there for this. I want to talk about your restaurant because that's a huge, huge step
yes.
for anyone. So June you open, right?
Yes.
And you fundraise on Kickstarter.
Yes. So I want to say 1/8 of what we needed was funded on Kickstarter. So Kickstarter was really about getting a community of believers to help push me over the line. And when we did Kickstarter, we did the Kickstarter to let people know that I was opening a restaurant because I was very vocal about never wanting a restaurant. I did not want a
Why
restaurant.
Why didn't you want one?
I didn't want one because I think I was thinking Top Chef, fine dining. I didn't feel that was my thing. I'm more of a joint girl. I want casual. I like the conversations that happen in casual restaurants. I like the feel of just maybe throwing your arm over the chair and not being so proper and polite. You know what I mean?
Totally. Accessible.
Accessible. And that's what I love. And that's the dining experience that honestly I like. When I go into a town, I'm like, you know, where do the locals go? You know, where do they hang out? So I didn't really reevaluate my dream or idea of a restaurant. I just said, I don't want it. And so my business partner had come to me and he was like, okay, let's do a restaurant. He was like, 3 years. He badgered me. Badger, 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 literally. And so November of 2013, he says, hey, Carla, I have this space I want you to see for our restaurant. I'm like, I don't want a restaurant. Okay, let me go tell this dude, you know, to his face, I do not want a restaurant. And I went to see it, and it was a restaurant. It was an old Lobel's place on the Upper East Side, sort of midtown. And I went in, and it felt like a meet and three to me. And I was like, oh, okay, this reminds me of those restaurants in Nashville. And I said, okay, I'm interested in talking about it. And the feeling of opening a restaurant bugged me for about a month. And so then I went to Mario. I said, Mario and Michael. And just having them there as people to talk to, I said, I'm thinking about opening a restaurant. And Mario says, if you open one, make it really tight. I mean, I said, I know I want it to be fast casual. He said, make it really tight. You know, what would it be if it was just something that really meant something to you? And I said, it would probably be Nashville style hot chicken and I'll just do sides. He said, that's what you should do then. You know, and even though there were a lot of chicken places opening up, and it took 2.5 years. So in the 2.5 years that it took us to open, there are all of these hot chicken places come. So by the time my restaurant opened, it's like I'm following this trend, which I don't really care about trends. Because, I mean, honestly, you talk about trends to me and I'm like, okay, insert eye roll. I really don't care about trends. So, you know, it's really about me sharing the food that I had at my grandmother's house. And so this restaurant truly is very personal, is very much a love letter to my hometown of Nashville. It's a love letter to my family and most of all my grandmothers, Thelma and Freddie Mae. And when you come in, you feel that.
What along the way has been the toughest lesson with the restaurant?
Oh my gosh. I think the first thing that comes to mind is telling people that I was doing it before it was ready. And honestly, the Kickstarter was great, but there was a lot of pressure to deliver on those rewards that people paid for. And it took a year and a half after we did the Kickstarter campaign to raise more money and to do all that. So that was hard. And I think that, but in that time, and I believe I needed that time to consciously come into the space of the restaurant. So I wouldn't have it any other way, even though it was really, really hard.
You really strike me as someone who wouldn't want to let anyone down.
It's true. And looking at those names, looking at my community of believers and all those Kickstarter supporters and their names are on the wall, I looked at those names. As much as they think that we did not think about them, I looked at those names every day. And I still do. I say, thank you. You're my community of believers, and I cannot let you down. And that's what kept me going and putting one step in front of the other every day.
I can see how much that mattered to you, how much it still means to you. Let's talk tips.
Yes.
What do you have for us?
I have tons of tips, but I think all of the cooking starts at the store. It really does, because you have to plan ahead. You have to make your list. You have to make your menu, but then you have to go to the store, right? And going to the store, it can be several stores. It can be one great store that's comprehensive and has everything. And so that's why I partnered with Aldi, because I don't think that you should sacrifice quality and premium products for value. So I'm all about, and on the Chew, I talk about it, you know, about a good deal, how I love a good deal.
Oh, I love a good deal.
You know, right? And I'm kind of cheap, right? You know, I love a good deal. So
there's an endorphin rush you get from a good deal. It's pretty awesome.
Isn't it funny? Because, you know, it's a pride. It's very prideful when you get a good deal. But I think when you go to a store and it has the staples as well as the cookware, as well as like the decor and all of your, the things that you're going to use for appetizers and beautiful cheeses and meats. It's like everything is there, even the things that you didn't think of. So yes, go in with the list, but also be open to being surprised and having those specials and all of the things that are going to make your life much easier.
Before we go, best advice you've received in your life, Carla?
I really think the best advice was from my grandmother saying, you know, it's your job to be happy, not rich. And I think about that every day, and that's what I do. And that's why when you see me doing something on television or, you know, talking about a brand that I like, I'm honestly happy about it, because I can truly tell you I believe in it and it gives me such joy.
Carla, thank you.
Thank you so much. This has been really fun.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of No Limits. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe, rate us, tell your friends, and if there's someone you think we should have on the show, let me know. You can tweet me at Rebecca Jarvis, and of course you can follow along with us behind the scenes on Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat. And special thanks to the team here at ABC that helps make this happen. It is a big one. Taylor Dunn, Josh Cohan, Andrew Kelb, Michelle Buncardo, Steve Jones, Erica Scott, and Elizabeth Hecht. And join me next Tuesday for an all-new episode of No Limits with Rebecca Jarvis. Until then, take care, be well.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.